Trent read off the names and ages of the accident victims, and his aide on the floor uncovered the first graphic, a black-and-white photo of the scene. He took his time, allowing people to absorb the image, to imagine what it must have been like for the occupants of the two cars. In the press gallery, copies of his prepared remarks and the photos were now being passed out, and he didn't want to go too fast. "Mr. Speaker, we must now ask, first, why did these people die, and second, why their deaths are a matter of concern to this House. A bright young federal government engineer, Miss Rebecca Upton, was called to the scene by the local police authorities and immediately determined that the accident was caused by a major safety defect in both of these automobiles, that the lethal fire was in fact caused by the faulty design of the fuel tanks on both cars. Mr. Speaker, only a short time ago, those very gasoline tanks were the subject of the domestic content negotiations between the United States and Japan. A superior product made, coincidentally, in my own district was proposed to the Japanese trade representative. The American component is both superior in design and less expensive in manufacture due to the diligence and intelligence of American workers. But that component was rejected by the Japanese trade mission because it failed to meet the supposed high and demanding standards of their own industry. Mr. Speaker, those high and demanding standards burn five American citizens to death in an auto accident, which, according to the Tennessee State Police and the National Transportation Safety Board, did not in any way exceed the safety parameters set in America by law for more than 15 years. This should have been a survivable accident, but one family is nearly wiped out, but for the courage of a union trucker, would be entirely gone. And to other families today weep over the bodies of their young daughters because American workers were not allowed to supply a superior component even to the versions of this automobile made right here in America. One of those faulty tanks was transported 6,000 miles so that it could be in one of those burned-out cars, so that it could kill a husband and a wife and a 3-year-old child and a newborn infant riding in that automobile. Enough is enough, Mr. Speaker. The preliminary findings of the NTSB confirmed by the scientific staff at Oak Ridge National Laboratory is that the auto gas tanks on both these cars, one manufactured in Japan and the other assembled right here in Kentucky, failed to meet long-standing DOT standards for automotive safety. As a result, first, the U.S. Department of Transportation has issued an immediate recall notice for all Cresta-type private passenger automobiles. Trent paused, looking around. The players in the room knew that there would be more, and they knew it would be a big one. Second, I have advised the President of this tragic incident and its larger ramifications. It has been also determined by the Department of Transportation that the same fuel tank for this particular brand of automobile is used in nearly every Japanese private passenger auto imported into the United States. Accordingly, I am today introducing a bill, H.R. 12313, which will authorize the President to direct the Departments of Commerce, Justice, and of the Treasury to... By executive order, the White House press spokesman was saying in the White House press room, and in the interest of public safety, the President has directed the Bureau of Customs Department of the Treasury to inspect all imported Japanese cars at their respective ports of entry for a major safety defect, which 2 days ago resulted in the deaths of five American citizens. Enabling legislation to formalize the President's statutory authority is being introduced today by the Honorable Alan Trent, Congressman from Massachusetts. The bill will have the full support of the president, and we hope for rapid action, again in the interest of public safety. The technical term for this measure is sectoral reciprocity, she went on. That means that our legislation will mirror image Japanese trade practices in every detail. She looked up for questions. Oddly, there were none at the moment. Moving on, the president's trip to Moscow has been scheduled for... Wait a minute, a reporter asked, looking up, having had a few seconds to digest the opening statement. What was that you said? What gives, boss? Ryan asked, going over the briefing documents.
Second page, Jack.
Okay. Jack flipped the page and scanned. Damn, I saw that on TV the other day, he looked up. This is not going to make them happy.
Tough cookies, President Durling replied coldly.
We actually had a good year or two closing the trade gap, but this new guy over there is so beholden to the big shots that we just can't do business with his people. Enough's enough. They stop our cars right on the dock and practically take them apart to make sure they're safe and then pass on the inspection bill to their customers.
I know that, sir, but enough's enough.
And, besides, it would soon be an election year, and the president needed help with his union voters and with this single stroke. He'd set that in granite. It wasn't Jack's bailiwick, and the National Security Advisor knew better than to make an issue of this.
Tell me about Russia and the missiles, Roger Durling said next.
He was saving the real bombshell for last. The FBI was having its meeting with the people from Judiciary the following afternoon.
No, Durling thought after a moment's contemplation. He'd have to call Bill Shaw and tell him to hold off. He didn't want two big stories competing on the front pages. Keelty would have to wait for a while. He'd let Ryan know, but the sexual harassment case would stay black for another week or so.
The timing guaranteed confusion. From a time zone 14 hours ahead of the United States EST, phones rang in the darkness of what in Washington was the early morning of the next day. The irregular nature of the American action, which had bypassed the normal channels within the American government and therefore had also bypassed the people who gathered information for their country, caught everyone completely unaware. The Japanese ambassador in Washington was in a fashionable restaurant, having lunch with a close friend, and the hour guaranteed that the same was true of the senior staffers at the embassy on Massachusetts Avenue Northwest. In the embassy cafeteria and all over the city, beepers went off, commanding an immediate call to their offices, but it was too late. The word was already out on various satellite TV channels, and those people in Japan who kept watch on such things had called their supervisors and so on up the information chain, until various zaibatsu were awakened at an hour certain to draw sharp comments. These men in turn called senior staff members who were already awake in any case and told them to call their lobbyists at once. Many of the lobbyists were already at work. For the most part, they had caught the C-SPAN coverage of Al Trent and gone to work on their own initiative, attempting damage control even before they received marching orders from their employers. The reception they got in every office was cool, even from members to whose campaign funds they made regular contributions. But not always. Look, said one senator, contemplating the commencement of his own re-election bid and needing funds, as his visitor well knew. I'm not going to the voters and saying that this action is unfair when eight people just burned to death. You have to give it time and let it play out. Be smart about it, okay? It was only five people who'd burned to death, the lobbyist thought, but the advice of his current mendicant was sound, or would have been under normal circumstances. The lobbyist was paid over $300,000 per year for his expertise. He'd been a senior Senate staffer for 10 years before seeing the light, and to be an honest broker of information. He was also paid to purvey campaign funds, not so honestly on one hand, and to advise his employers what was possible on the other. Okay, Senator, he said in an understanding tone. Please remember, though, that this legislation could cause a trade war, and that would be bad for everyone. Events like this have a natural life, and they don't last forever, the senator replied. That was the general opinion reported back to the various offices by 5 that afternoon, which translated to 7 the following morning in Japan.
The error was in overlooking the fact that there had never been an event quite like this. Already the phones were ringing in the offices of nearly every member of both houses of Congress. Most expressed outrage at the event on I-40, which was to be expected. There were a few hundred thousand people in America, spread through every state and all 435 congressional districts, who never missed the chance to call their representatives in Washington to express their opinions on everything. Junior staffers took the calls and made note of the time and date, the name and address of every caller. It was often unnecessary to ask, as some callers were identifiable by voice alone. The calls would be catalogued for topic and opinion, become part of every member's morning briefing information, and in most cases just as quickly forgotten. Other calls went to more senior staff members, and in many cases to the members themselves. These came from local businessmen, mostly manufacturers, whose products either competed directly in the marketplace with those from overseas, or in a small number of cases who'd tried to do business in Japan and found the going difficult. These calls were not always heeded, but they were rarely ignored. It was now a top story again on every news service, having briefly faded into the normal old news obscurity. For today's newscasts, family photographs were shown of the police officer and his wife and their three children, and also of Nora Dunn and Amy Rice, followed by a brief taped interview of the heroic truck driver and distant views of Jessica Denton, orphan, writhing in pain from her burns inside a laminar room being treated by nurses who wept as they debrided her charred face and arms. Now lawyers were sitting with all of the involved families, coaching them on what to tell the cameras and preparing dangerously modest statements of their own, while visions of contingency fees danced in their heads. News crews asked for the reaction of family members, friends, and neighbors, and in the angry grief of people who had suffered a sudden and bitter loss, others saw either common anger or an opportunity to take advantage of the situation. But most telling of all was the story of the fuel tank itself. The preliminary NTSB finding had been leaked moments after its existence had been announced on the floor of the House. It was just too good to pass up. The American Auto Company supplied their own engineers to explain the scientific side of the matter, each of them noting with barely concealed glee that it was a simple example of poor quality control on a very simple automobile component, that the Japanese weren't as sharp as everyone thought after all. "Look, Tom, people have been galvanizing steel for over a century," a mid-level Ford engineer explained to NBC Nightly News. "Garbage cans are made out of this stuff." "Garbage cans?" the anchor inquired with a blank look, since his were made from plastic. "They've hammered us on quality control for years, told us that we're not good enough, not safe enough, not careful enough to enter their auto market. And now we see that they're not so smart after all. That's the bottom line, Tom," the engineer went on, feeling his oats. The gas tanks on those two Crestas had less structural integrity than a garbage can made with 1890s technology, and that's why those five people burned to death. That incidental remark proved the label for the entire event. The next morning, five galvanized steel trash cans were found stacked at the entrance to the Cresta plant in Kentucky, along with a sign that read, "Why don't you try these?" A CNN crew picked it up, having been tipped off beforehand, and by noon, that was their headline story. It was all a matter of perception. It would take weeks to determine what had really gone wrong, but by that time perception and the reactions to it would have long since overtaken reality. The master of MV Nissan Courier hadn't received any notice at all. His was a surprisingly ugly ship that looked for all the world as though she'd begun life as a solid rectangular block of steel, then had its bow scooped out with a large spoon for conversion into something that could move at sea. Top-heavy and cursed with a huge sail area that often made her the plaything of even the gentlest winds, she required four Moran tugboats to dock at the Dundalk Marine Terminal in the port of Baltimore. Once the city's first airport, the large, flat expanse was a natural receiving point for automobiles. The ship's captain controlled the complex and tricky evolution of coming alongside, only then to notice that the enormous car park was unusually full. That was odd, he thought. The last Nissan ship had come in the previous Thursday, and ordinarily the lot should have been half empty by now, making room for his cargo. Looking farther, he saw only three car trailers waiting to load their own cargo for transport to the nearest distributor. Normally, they were lined up like taxis at a train station. I guess they weren't kidding, the Chesapeake Bay pilot observed. He'd boarded the courier at the Virginia Capes and had caught the TV news on the pilot ship that anchored there. He shook his head and made his way to the accommodation ladder. He'd let the shipping agent give the word to the master. The shipping agent did just that, climbing up the ladder, then to the bridge. The storage lot had room for about 200 additional cars, certainly not more than that, and as yet he had no instructions from the line's management on what to tell the captain to do. Ordinarily, the ship would be in port for no more than 24 hours, the time required to unload the cars, refuel, and revictual the ship for her return journey most of the way across the world, where the same routine would be followed in reverse, this time loading cars into the empty ship for yet another voyage to America. The ships of this fleet were on a boring but remorseless schedule whose dates were as fixed as the stars of the night sky.
"What do you mean?" the master asked.
"Every car has to be safety inspected," the shipping agent waved toward the terminal. "See for yourself." The master did just that, lifting his Nikon binoculars to see agents from the Bureau of Customs, six of them, using a hydraulic jack to lift up a new car so that one of their number could crawl under it for some reason or other, while others made notations on various official forms on their clipboards. Certainly they didn't seem to be in much of a hurry. Through the glasses he could see their bodies rock back and forth in what had to be mirth, instead of working as diligently as government employees ought. That was the reason he didn't make the connection with the odd instances on which he'd seen Japanese customs inspectors doing similar but much more stringent inspections of American, German, or Swedish cars on the docks of his home port of Yokohama.
"But we could be here for days," the master blurted out.
"Maybe a week," the agent said optimistically.
"But there's only space for one ship. Nissan Voyager is due here in 70 hours.
"I can't help that."
"But my schedule."
There was genuine horror in the master's voice.
"I can't help that either," the shipping agent observed patiently to a man whose predictable world had just disintegrated.
"How can we help?" Seiji Nagumo asked.
"What do you mean?" the Commerce Department official replied.
"This terrible accident."
And Nagumo was genuinely horrified. Japan's historical construction of wood and paper had long since been replaced by more substantial buildings, but its legacy was a deep cultural dread of fire. A citizen who allowed a fire to start on his property and then to spread to the property of another still faced criminal sanctions, not mere civil liability. He felt a very real sense of shame that a product manufactured in his country had caused such a horrible end.
"I have not yet had an official communique from my government, but I tell you for myself, this is terrible beyond words. I assure you that we will launch our own investigation."
"It's a little late for that, Seiji. As you will recall, we discussed this very issue."
"Yes, that is true, I admit it. But you must understand that even if we had reached an agreement, the materials in question would still have been in the pipeline. It would not have made a difference to these people."
It was an altogether pleasant moment for the American trade negotiator. The deaths in Tennessee, well, that was too bad, but he'd been putting up with this bastard's arrogance for 3 years now, and the current situation, for all its tragedy, was a sweet one.
"Seiji-san, as I said, it's a little late for that. I suppose we will be happy to have some degree of cooperation from your people, but we have our own job to do. After all, I'm sure you'll understand that the duty to protect the lives and safety of American citizens is properly the job of the American government. Clearly, we have been remiss in that duty, and we must make up for our own unfortunate failings."
"What we can do, Robert, is to subsidize the operation. I have been told that our auto manufacturers will themselves hire safety inspectors
to clear the vehicles in your ports, and...
Seiji, you know that's unacceptable. We can't have government functions carried out by industry representatives. That wasn't true, and the bureaucrat knew it. It happened all the time. In the interest of maintaining our friendly trade relationship, we offer to undertake any unusual expense incurred by your government. We... Nagumo was stopped by a raised hand. Seiji, I have to tell you to stop there. Please, you must understand that what you propose could well be seen as an inducement to corruption under our government ethics laws. The conversation stopped cold for several seconds. Look, Seiji, when the new statute is passed, this will settle out rapidly, and that wouldn't take long. A flood of mail and telegrams from rapidly organized grassroots groups, the United Auto Workers, for one, smelling blood in the water as sharply as any shark, had directed every one of its members to dial up Western Union for precisely that purpose. The Trent Bill was already first in line for hearings on the Hill, and insiders gave the new statute 2 weeks before it appeared on the President's desk for signature.
But Trent's Bill...
The Commerce Department official leaned forward on his desk. Seiji, what's the problem? The Trent Bill will allow the President, with the advice of lawyers here at Commerce, to duplicate your own trade laws. In other words, what we will do is to mirror image your own laws over here. Now, how can it possibly be unfair for Americans to use your own fair trade laws on your products the same way that you use them on ours? Nagumo hadn't quite got it until that moment.
But you don't understand. Our laws are designed to fit our culture. Yours is different, and...
Yes, Seiji, I know. Your laws are designed to protect your industries against unfair competition. What we will soon be doing is the same thing. Now, that's the bad news. The good news is that whenever you open markets to us, we will automatically do the same for you. The bad news, Seiji, is that we will apply your own laws to your own products, and then, my friend, we will see how fair your laws are by your own standards. Why are you upset? You've been telling me for years how your laws are not a real boundary at all, that it's the fault of American industry that we can't trade with Japan as effectively as you trade with us. He leaned back and smiled. Okay, now we'll see how accurate your observations were. You're not telling me now that you misled me on things, are you? Nagumo would have thought, my God, had he been a Christian. But his religion was animistic, and his internal reactions were different, though of exactly the same significance. He had just been called a liar, and the worst part was that the accusation was true. The Trent Bill, now officially called the Trade Reform Act, was explained to America that very evening, now that the talking heads had used the time to analyze it. Its philosophical simplicity was elegant. Administration spokesman and Trent himself on MacNeil Lehrer explained that the law established a small committee of lawyers and technical trade experts from the Commerce Department, assisted by international law authorities from the Department of Justice, who would be empowered to analyze foreign trade laws, to draft American trade regulations that matched their provisions as exactly as possible, and then to recommend them to the Secretary of Commerce, who would advise the President. The President, in turn, had the authority to activate those regulations by executive order. The order could be voided by a simple majority of both houses of Congress, whose authority on such matters was set in the Constitution. That provision would avoid legal challenge on the grounds of separation of powers. The Trade Reform Act further had a sunset provision. In 4 years from enactment, it would automatically cease to exist unless reenacted by Congress and reapproved by the sitting president. That provision made the TRA appear to be a temporary provision, whose sole objective was to establish free international trade once and for all. It was manifestly a lie, but a plausible one, even for those who knew it.
"Now, what could be more fair than that?" Trent asked rhetorically on PBS. "All we are doing is to duplicate the laws of other countries. If their laws are fair for American businesses, then those same laws must also be fair for the industries of other countries. Our Japanese friends," he smiled, have been telling us for years that their laws are not discriminatory. Fine. We will use their laws as fairly as they do.
The entertaining part for Trent was in watching the man on the other side of the table squirm. The former Assistant Secretary of State, now earning over $1 million a year as senior lobbyist for Sony and Mitsubishi, just sat there, his mind racing for something to say that would make sense, and Trent could see it in his face. He didn't have a thing.
"This could be the start of a real trade war," he began, only to be cut off at the ankles.
"Look, Sam, the Geneva Convention didn't cause any wars, did it? It simply applied the same rules of conduct to all sides in a conflict. If you're saying that the use of Japanese regulations in American parts will cause a war, then there already is a war, and you've been working for the other side, haven't you?"
His rapid-fire retort was met with 5 seconds of very awkward silence. There just wasn't an answer to that question.
"Whoa," Ryan observed, sitting in the family room of his house, at a decent hour for once.
"He's got real killer instinct," Kathy observed, looking up from some medical notes.
"He does," her husband agreed. "Talk about fast. I just got briefed in on this the other day."
"Well, I think they're right, don't you?" his wife asked.
"I think it's going a little fast," Jack paused.
"How good are their docs?"
"Japanese doctors?
Not very, by our standards."
"Really?"
The Japanese public health system had been held up for emulation. Everything over there was free, after all.
"How come?"
"They salute too much," Kathy replied, her head back down in her notes.
"The professor's always right, that sort of thing. The young ones never learn to do it on their own, and by the time they're old enough to become professors themselves, for the most part they forget how."
"How often are you wrong, O associate professor of ophthalmic surgery, ma'am?" Jack chuckled.
"Practically never," Kathy replied, looking up. "But I never tell my residents to stop asking why, either. We have 3 Japanese fellows at Wilmer now. Good clinicians, good technical docs, but not very flexible. I guess it's a cultural thing. We're trying to train them out of it. It's not easy."
"The boss is always right."
"Not always, he isn't." Kathy made a notation for a medication change.
Ryan's head turned, wondering if he just learned something important. "How good are they in developing new treatments?"
"Jack, why do you think they come here to train? Why do you suppose we have so many in the university up on Charles Street? Why do you suppose so many of them stay here?"
It was 9 in the morning in Tokyo, and a satellite feed brought the American evening news shows into executive offices all over the city. Skilled translators were rendering the conversation into their native tongue. VCRs were making a permanent record for a more thorough analysis later, but what the executives heard was clear enough. Kozo Matsuda trembled at his desk. He kept his hands in his lap and out of view so that the others in his office could not see them shake. What he heard in 2 languages, his English was excellent, was bad enough. What he saw was worse. His corporation was already losing money due to irregularities in the world market. Fully a third of his company's products went to the United States, and if that segment of his business were in any way interrupted... The interview was followed by a focus segment that showed Nissan Courier still tied up in Baltimore, with her sister ship Nissan Voyager swinging at anchor in the Chesapeake Bay. Yet another car carrier had just cleared the Virginia Capes, and the first of the trio was not even halfway unloaded yet. The only reason they'd shown those particular ships was Baltimore's convenient proximity to Washington. The same was happening in the port of Los Angeles, Seattle, and Jacksonville. As though the cars were being used to transport drugs, Matsuda thought. Part of his mind was outraged, but more of it was approaching panic. If the Americans were serious, then... No, they couldn't be. "But what about the possibility of a trade war?" Jim Lehrer asked that Trent person.
"Jim, I've been saying for years that we've been in a trade war with Japan for a generation. What we've just done is to level the playing field for everyone."
"But if this situation goes further, won't American interests be hurt?"
"Jim, what are those interests?
Are American business interests worth burning up little children? Trent shot back at once.
Matsuda cringed when he heard that. The image was just too striking for a man whose earliest childhood memory was of the early morning of March 10, 1945. Not even 3 years old, his mother carrying him from his house, looking back and seeing the towering flames caused by Curtis LeMay's 21st Bomber Command. For years he'd awakened screaming in the night, and for all his adult life he'd been a committed pacifist. He'd studied history, learned how and why the war had begun, how America had pushed his antecedents into a corner from which there had been only a single escape, and that a false one. Perhaps Yamata was right, he thought. Perhaps the entire affair had been of America's making. First, force Japan into a war, then crush them in an effort to forestall the natural ascendancy of a nation destined to challenge American power. For all that, he had never been able to understand how the Zaibatsu of the time, members of the Black Dragon Society, had not been able to find a clever way out. For wasn't war just too dreadful an option? Wasn't peace, however humiliating, to be preferred to the awful destruction that came with war? It was different now. Now he was one of them, and now he saw what lay in the abyss of not going to war. Were they so wrong then, he asked himself, no longer hearing the TV or his translator. They'd sought real economic stability for their country, the Greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere. The history books of his youth had called it all a lie. But was it? For his country's economy to function, it needed resources, raw materials. But Japan had virtually none except coal, and that polluted the air. Japan needed iron, bauxite, petroleum, needed almost everything to be shipped in order to be transformed into finished goods that could be shipped out. They needed cash to pay for the raw materials, and that cash came from the buyers of the finished products. If America, his country's largest and most important trading partner, suddenly stopped trading, that cash flow would stop. Almost $60 billion. There would be various adjustments, of course. Today, on the international money markets, the yen would plummet against the dollar and every other hard currency in the world. That would make Japanese products less expensive everywhere. But Europe would follow suit. He was sure of that. Trade regulations already stiffer than the Americans would become tougher still. And that trading surplus would also decline. And at the same time, the value of the yen would fall all the more. It would take more cash to buy the resources without which his country would enter total collapse. Like falling from a precipice, the downward acceleration would merely grow faster and faster, and the only consolation of the moment was that he would not be there to see the end of it. For long before that happened, this office would no longer be his. He'd be disgraced with all the rest of his colleagues. Some would choose death, perhaps, but not so many. That was something for TV now, the ancient traditions that had grown from a culture rich in pride, but poor in everything else. Life was too comfortable to give it up so easily. Or was it? What lay 10 years in his country's future? A return to poverty or something else? The decision would partly be his, Matsuda told himself, because the government of his country was really an extension of the collective will of himself and his peers. He looked down at the shaking hands in his lap. He thanked his two employees and sent them on their way with a gracious nod before he was able to lift his hands to the surface of his desk and reach for a telephone. Clark thought of it as a forever flight, and even though KAL had upgraded them to first class, it really hadn't helped much. Not even the charming Korean flight attendants in lovely traditional dress could make the process much better than it was. He'd seen two of the three movies on other flights, and the third wasn't all that interesting. The Sky News radio channel had held his interest for the 40 minutes required to update him on the happenings of the world, but after that it became repetitive, and his memory was too finely trained to need that. The KAL magazine was only good for 30 minutes. Even that was a stretch, and he was current on the American news journals. What remained was crushing boredom. At least Ding had his course material to divert him. He was currently reading through the Massey's classic Dreadnought.
about how international relations had broken down a century earlier because the various European nations, more properly their leaders, had failed to make the leap of imagination required to keep the peace. Clark remembered having read it soon after publication.
"They just can't make it, can they?" he asked his partner after an hour of reading over his shoulder.
Ding read slowly, taking in every word one at a time.
Well, it was study material, wasn't it?
"Not real smart, John." Chavez looked up from his pages of notes and stretched, which was easier for his small frame than it was for Clark's. "Professor Alfer wants me to identify 3 or 4 crucial fault points for my thesis, bad decisions, that sort of thing. More to it than that, you know? What they had to do was, well, like step outside themselves and look back and see what it was all about. But the dumb fucks didn't know how to do that. They couldn't be objective. The other part is they didn't think anything all the way through. They had all those great tactical ideas, but they never really looked at where things were leading them. You know, I can identify the goofs for the doc, wrap it up real nice just like she wants, but it's going to be bullshit, John. The problem wasn't the decisions, the problem was the people making them. They just weren't big enough for what they were doing. They just didn't see far enough, and that's what the peons were paying them to do, you know? Chavez rubbed his eyes, grateful for the distraction. He'd been reading and studying for 11 hours with only brief breaks for meals and head calls. "I need to run a few miles," he grumped, also weary from the flight. John checked his watch. 40 minutes out, we've already started our descent. "You suppose the big shots are any different today?" Ding asked tiredly. Clark laughed. "My boy, what's the one thing in life that never changes?" The young officer smiled. "Yeah, and the other one is people like us are always caught in the open when they blow it." He rose and walked to the head to wash his face. Looking in the mirror, he was glad that they'd spend a day at an agency safe house. He'd need to wash up and shave and unwind before putting on his mission identity. And maybe make some start notes for his thesis. Clark looked out the window and saw a Korean landscape lit up with the pink, feathery light of a breaking dawn. The lad was turning intellectual on him. That was enough for a weary, eyes-closed grin with his face turned to the plastic window. The kid was smart enough, but what would happen when Ding wrote the dumb fucks didn't know how into his master's thesis? He was talking about Gladstone and Bismarck, after all. That got him laughing so hard that he started coughing in the airliner dry air. He opened his eyes to see his partner emerge from the first-class head. Ding almost bumped into one of the flight attendants, and though he smiled politely at her and stepped aside to let her pass, he didn't track her with his eyes, Clark noticed. Didn't do what men usually did with someone so young and attractive. Clearly his mind was set on another female form. Damn, this is getting serious. Murray nearly exploded. "We can't do that now. God damn it, Bill, we've got everything lined up. The information's going to leak sure as hell, and that's not even fair to Kielty, much less our witnesses." "We do work for the President," Dan Shaw pointed out, "and the order came directly from him, not even through the AG. Since when did you care about Kielty anyway?" It was, in fact, the same line Shaw had used on President Durling. Bastard or not, rapist or not, he was entitled to due process of law and a fair crack at defending himself. The FBI was somewhat maniacal on that, but the real reason for their veneration of judicial fair play was that when you convicted a guy after following all the rules, you knew that you'd nailed the right bastard. It also made the appeals process a lot easier to swallow. "This accident thing, right?" "Yeah, he doesn't want 2 big stories jockeying on the front page. This trade flap is a pretty big deal, and he says Kielty can wait a week or two." "Dan, our Miss Linders has waited several years. Will another couple of weeks?" "Yes, and you know it," Murray snapped back. Then he paused. "Sorry, Bill. You know what I mean." What he meant was simple. He had a case ready to go, and it was time to run with it. On the other hand, you didn't say no to the President. He's already talked to the people on the hill. They'll sit on it.
But their staffers won't.
Chapter 10. Seduction. I agree it's not good, Chris Cook said. Nagumo was looking down at the rug in the sitting room. He was too stunned at the events of the previous few days even to be angry. It was like discovering that the world was about to end and that there was nothing he could do about it. Supposedly, he was a middle-level foreign ministry official who didn't play in the high-level negotiations. But that was window dressing. His task was to set the framework for his country's negotiating positions, and moreover, to gather intelligence information on what America really thought, so that his titular seniors would know exactly what opening positions to take and how far they could press. Nagumo was an intelligence officer, in fact, if not in name. In that role, his interest in the process was personal and surprisingly emotional. Seiji saw himself as a defender and protector of his country and its people, and also as an honest bridge between his country and America. He wanted Americans to appreciate his people and his culture. He wanted them to partake of its products. He wanted America to see Japan as an equal, a good and wise friend from whom to learn. Americans were a passionate people, so often ignorant of their real needs, as the overly proud and pampered often are. The current American stance on trade, if that was what it seemed to be, was like being slapped by one's own child. Didn't they know they needed Japan and its products? Hadn't he personally trained American trade officials for years? Cook squirmed in his seat. He, too, was an experienced Foreign Service officer, and he could read faces as well as anyone. They were friends, after all, and more than that. Seiji was his personal passport to a remunerative life after government service. If it makes you feel any better, it's the 13th. Hmm? Nagumo looked up. That's the day they blow up the last missiles. The thing you asked about, remember? Nagumo blinked, slow to recall the question he'd posed earlier. Why then? The president will be in Moscow. They're down to a handful of missiles now. I don't know the exact number, but it's less than 20 on each side. They're saving the last one for next Friday. Kind of an odd coincidence, but that's how the scheduling worked out. The TV boys have been prepped, but they're keeping it quiet. There'll be cameras at both places, and they're going to simulcast the last two. Blowing them up, I mean. Cook paused. So that ceremony you talked about, the one for your grandfather, that's the day. Thank you, Chris. Nagumo stood and walked to the bar to pour himself another drink. He didn't know why the ministry wanted that information, but it was an order, and he'd pass it along. Now, my friend, what can we do about this? Not much, Seiji, at least not right away. I told you about the damn gas tanks, remember? I told you Trent was not a guy to tangle with. He's been waiting for an opportunity like this for years. Look, I was on the hill this afternoon talking to people. You've never seen mail and telegrams like this one, and goddamn CNN won't let the story go. I know, Nagumo nodded. It was like some sort of horror movie. Today's lead story was Jessica Denton. The whole country, along with a lot of the world, was following a recovery. She had just come off the grave list with her medical condition upgraded to critical. There were enough flowers outside her laminar room to give the impression of a lavish personal garden. But the second story of the day had been the burial of her parents and siblings, delayed by medical and legal necessities. Hundreds had attended, including every member of Congress from Tennessee. The chairman of the auto company had wanted to attend as well to pay personal respects and apologize in person to the family, but been warned off for security reasons. He'd offered a sincere apology on behalf of his corporation on TV instead and promised to cover all medical expenses and provide for Jessica's continuing education, pointing out that he also had daughters. Somehow it just hadn't worked. A sincere apology went a long way in Japan, a fact that Boeing had cashed in on when one of their 747s had killed several hundred Japanese citizens. But it wasn't the same in America, a fact Nagumo had vainly communicated to his government.
The attorney for the Denton family, a famous and effective litigator, had thanked the chairman for his apology and noted dryly that responsibility for the deaths was now on the public record, simplifying his case preparation. It was only a question of amount now. It was already whispered that he demanded $1 billion. Deerfield Auto Parts was in negotiation with every Japanese auto assembler, and Nagumo knew that the terms to be offered the Massachusetts company would be generous in the extreme. But he'd also told the foreign ministry the American adage about closing the barn door after the horse had escaped. It would not be damage control at all, but merely a further admission of fault, which was the wrong thing to do in the American legal environment. The news had taken a while to sink in at home. As horrid as the auto accident had been, it seemed a small thing, and TV commentators on NHK had used the 747 incident to illustrate that accidents did happen, and that America had once inflicted something similar in type, but far more ghastly in magnitude, on the citizens of that country. But to American eyes, the Japanese story had appeared to be justification rather than comparison, and the American citizens who'd backed it up were people known to be on the Japanese payroll. It was all coming apart. Newspapers were printing lists of former government officials who had entered such employment, noting their job experience and former salaries, and comparing them with what they were doing now and for how much. Mercenary was the kindest term applied to them. Traitor was one more commonly used epithet, especially by organized labor and every member of Congress who faced election. There was no reasoning with these people. "What will happen, Chris?" Cook set his drink down on the table, evaluating his own position and lamenting his remarkably bad timing. He had already begun cutting his strings. Waiting the extra few years for full retirement benefits, he'd done the calculations a few months earlier. Seiji had made it known to him the previous summer that his actual net income would quadruple to start with, and that his employers were great believers in pension planning, and that he wouldn't lose his federal retirement investments, would he? And so Cook had started the process. Speaking sharply to the next higher career official to whom he reported, letting others know that he thought his country's trade policy was being formulated by idiots, in the knowledge that his views would work their way upward. A series of internal memoranda that said the same thing in measured bureaucratese. He had to set things up so that his departure would not be a surprise and would seem to be based on principle rather than crass lucre. The problem was, in doing so, he'd effectively ended his career. He would never be promoted again, and if he remained at State, at best he might find himself posted to an ambassadorship to maybe Sierra Leone, unless they could find a bleaker spot. Equatorial Guinea, perhaps? More bugs. "You're committed," Cook told himself, and so he took a deep breath, and on reflection another sip of his drink. "Seiji, we're going to have to take the long view on this one. TRA, he couldn't call it the Trade Reform Act, not here, is going to pass in less than 2 weeks, and the president's going to sign it. The working groups at Commerce and Justice are already forming up. State will participate also, of course. Cables have gone out to several embassies to get copies of various trade laws around the world." "Not just ours," Nagumo was surprised. "They're going to compare yours with others from countries with whom our trade relations are less controversial right now." Cook had to watch his language, after all. He needed this man. "The idea is to give them something to, well, to contrast your country's laws with. Anyway, getting this thing fixed, it's going to take some time, Seiji." Which wasn't an altogether bad thing, Cook reasoned. After all, it made for job security, if and when he crossed over from one employer to another.
"Will you be part of the working group?"
"Probably, yes."
"Your help will be invaluable, Chris," Nagumo said quietly, thinking more rapidly now. "I can help you with interpreting our laws. Quietly, of course," he added, seizing at that particular straw. I wasn't really planning to stay at Foggy Bottom much longer, Seiji, Cook observed. We've got our hearts set on a new house, and, Chris, we need you where you are. I need your help to mitigate this unfortunate set of circumstances. We have a genuine emergency on our hands, one with serious consequences for both our countries. I understand that, but money, Nagumo thought. With these people, it's always money. I can make the proper arrangements, he said, more on annoyed impulse than as a considered thought. Only after he'd spoken did he grasp what he'd done, and then he was interested to see how Cook would react to it. The Deputy Assistant Secretary of State just sat there for a moment. He, too, was so caught up in the events that the real implications of the offer nearly slipped past him. Cook simply nodded without even looking up into Nagumo's eyes. In retrospect, the first step, the turning over of national security information, had been a harder one, and the second was so easy that Cook didn't even reflect on the fact that now he was in clear violation of a federal statute. He had just agreed to provide information to a foreign government for money. It seemed such a logical thing to do under the circumstances. They really wanted that house in Potomac, and it wouldn't be long before they'd have to start shopping for colleges. That morning on the Nikkei Dow would long be remembered. It had taken that long for people to grasp what Seiji Nagumo now knew, that they weren't kidding this time. It wasn't rice all over again. It wasn't computer chips all over again. It wasn't automobiles or their parts, not telecommunications gear or construction contracts or cellular phones. It was, in fact, all of the above, 20 years of pent-up resentment and anger, some justified, some not, but all real and exploding to the surface at a single time. At first, the editors in Tokyo just hadn't believed what they had been told by their people in Washington and New York, and had redrafted the stories to fit their own conclusions, until they themselves had thought the information through and come to the stunning realization on their own. The Trade Reform Act the papers had pontificated only 2 days earlier was just one more blip, a joke, an expression of a few misguided people with a long history of antipathy to our country that will soon run its course. It was now something else. Today it was a most unfortunate development whose possibility of enactment into federal law cannot now be totally discounted. The Japanese language conveys information every bit as well as any other once you break the code. In America, the headlines are far more explicit, but that is merely an indelicate directness of expression typical of the gaijin. In Japan, one talked more elliptically, but the meaning was there even so, just as clear, just as plain. The millions of Japanese citizens who owned stock read the same papers, saw the same morning news, and reached the same conclusions. On reaching their workplaces, they lifted phones and made their calls. The Nikkei Dow had once ridden beyond 30,000 yen of benchmark value. By the early 1990s, it had fallen to half of that, and the aggregate cash cost of the write-down was a number larger than the entire U.S. government debt at the time, a fact which had gone virtually unnoticed in the United States, but not by those who had taken their money from banks and placed it in stocks in an attempt to get something more than a 2% compounded annualized return. Those people had lost sizable fractions of their life savings and not known whom to blame for it. Not this time, they all thought. It was time to cash in and put the money back into banks. Big, safe financial institutions that knew how to protect their depositors' funds. Even if they were niggardly in paying interest, you didn't lose anything, did you? Western reporters would use terms like avalanche and meltdown to describe what began when the trading computers went online. The process appeared to be orderly. The large commercial banks, married as they were to the large corporations, sent the same depositors money that came in the front door right out the back door to protect the value of corporate stocks. There was no choice, really. They had to buy up huge portfolios in what turned out to be a vain stand against a racing tide.
The Nikkei Dow lost fully a sixth of its net value in one trading day, and though analysts proclaimed confidently that the market was now grossly undervalued and a huge technical adjustment upward was inevitable, people thought in their own homes that if the American legislation really became law, the market for the goods their country made would vanish like the morning fog. The process would not stop, and though none said it, everyone knew it. This was especially clear to the bankers. On Wall Street, things were different. Various sages bemoaned the interference of government in the marketplace. Then they thought about it a little bit. It was plain to see, after all, that if Japanese automobiles had trouble clearing customs, that if the popular Cresta was now cursed with a visual event that few would soon put behind them, then American cars would sell more, and that was good. It was good for Detroit, where the cars were assembled, and for Pittsburgh, where much of the steel was still forged. It was good for all the cities in America, and Canada, and Mexico, where the thousands of components were made. It was good further for all the workers who made the parts and assembled the cars, who would have more money to spend in their communities for other things. How good? Well, the majority of the trade imbalance with Japan was accounted for in automobiles. The sunny side of $30 billion could well be dumped into the American economy in the next 12 months, and that, quite a few market technicians thought, after perhaps as much as 5 seconds' reflection, was just good as hell, wasn't it? Conservatively, $30 billion going into the coffers of various companies, and all of it one way or another, would show up as profits for American corporations. Even the additional taxes paid would help in lowering the federal deficit, thus lowering demands on the money pool and lowering the cost of government bonds. The American economy would be twice blessed. Toss in a little schadenfreude for their Japanese colleagues, and even before the street opened for business, people were primed for a big trading day. They would not be disappointed. The Columbus Group turned out to be especially well set, having a few days earlier purchased options for a huge quantity of auto-related issues, and thus able to take advantage of a 112-point upward jolt in the Dow. In Washington, at the Federal Reserve, there was concern. They were closer to the seat of government power and had insider information from the Treasury Department on how the mechanics of the Trade Reform Act would run, and it was clear that there would be a temporary shortage of automobiles until Detroit geared up its lines somewhat. Until the American companies could take up the slack, there would be the classic situation of too much money chasing too few cars. That meant an inflationary blip, and so later in the day the Fed would announce a quarter-point increase in the discount rate. Just a temporary one, they told people off the record, and not for attribution. The Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve, however, viewed the entire development as good in the long term. It would be myopic on their part, but then that condition was worldwide at the moment. Even before that decision was made, other men were discussing the long term as well. It required the largest hot tub in the bathhouse, which was then closed for the evening to its other well-heeled customers. The regular staff was dismissed. The clients would be served by personal assistants, who, it turned out, kept their distance as well. In fact, even the normal ablutions were dispensed with. After the most cursory of greetings, the men removed their jackets and ties and sat around on the floor, unwilling to waste time with the usual preliminaries. "It will be even worse tomorrow," a banker noted. That was all he had to say. Yamada looked around the room. It was all he could do not to laugh. The signs had been clear as much as 5 years before, when the first major auto company had quietly discontinued its lifetime employment policy. The free ride of Japanese business had actually ended then for those who had the wit to pay attention. The rest of them had thought all the reverses to be merely temporary irregularities, their favorite term for it. But their myopia had worked entirely in Yamada's favor. The shock value of what was happening now was his best friend. Disappointingly, but not surprisingly, only a handful of those in the room had seen it for what it was. In the main, those were Yamada-san's closest allies. Which was not to say that he or they had been immune to the adversity that had taken the national unemployment rate to almost 5%, merely that they had mitigated their damage by carefully considered measures.
Those measures were enough, however, to make their originators appear to be models of perspicacity. "There is an adage from the American Revolution," one of their number noted dryly. He had a reputation as something of an intellectual. "From their Benjamin of Franklin, I believe. We can either hang it together, or we will surely hang separately. If we do not stand together now, my friends, we will all be destroyed. One at a time or all at once, it will not matter." "And our country with us," the banker added, earning Yamata's gratitude.